Hello, I'm Jennifer Udden.
And I'm Bridget Smith.
Welcome to the inaugural episode of Shipping and Handling,
the podcast we started when we realized we're way too long-winded for Twitter. We've decided that today we're going to talk about conferences.
And drink champagne, because why not?
With straws.
With straws.
Out of cans.
Out of cans.
Classy operation.
I poured mine into a cup, but still. Bridget's double-fisting it, so... the reason we decided to talk about conferences today is because I have just returned, well, not just returned, a week ago returned, from attending Worldcon.
Mm-hmm.
And Bridget, why don't you explain to us what Worldcon is? Just kidding, I'll do it. Worldcon is the World Science Fiction Convention. It's held every year. Puzzlingly enough, a different committee plans it every year, which doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense to me, but...
That does seem like a recipe for disaster.
But that is a story for later in the podcast when I'm a little drunker. it is where the World Science Fiction... something starting with an F. I don't think it's Federation, but I think it's Foundation?
Oh, something, yeah.
Something gives out the Hugos.
Yep.
I will probably be drummed out of the profession for not remembering the name of that organization. And generally, it's just the biggest conference every year for...
science fiction fantasy conference in the world.
And yet, this year it was held as the same weekend as DragonCon, as indeed it has been for many years. It's held Labor Day weekend. And DragonCon is a multi-fandom, multimedia extravaganza... that was held, apparently, over 6 hotels and had over 70,000 people.
Oh my god.
Right? Right? I mean, Worldcon, like, it had its you know, drawbacks, but I think that I would be freaking out if that many people.
Part of the reason I've never been to New York Comic Con, even though I live here and have lived within 2 hours of it for my entire life, is because large crowds are the natural enemies of Bridget's. So, I just can't.
Large crowds are your enemies. You see them lurking around corners and you run the other way.
I do, no! In fact. I'm actually quite good at getting around crowds faster than anyone else can get through them.
Well, I mean, there were probably about 4,000 or 5,000 people at Worldcon. There was,
okay, that's manageable.
Yeah, it was a reasonable size. But it was definitely, I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this today is because there's a big difference between attending a fan conference and attending a pro conference,
mm-hmm.
and attending either one of those things as either a fan or a pro.
Yeah.
And by pro, I mean editor, publisher, agent, and to some extent author,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah, a lot of published authors wind up going less as fans and more as professionals because they wind up on panels and in programming and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. And by pro, I only kind of mean hooker.
Only a little bit. Only a teensy bit.
Only a teensy bit. I only showed a little bit of cleavage.
A professional amount.
A professional amount of cleavage. Jen and Bridget, setting back feminism since 2013. But I went because my client Emma was there. Emma mm-hmm. Newman, who is amazing, and everyone should go read her books. The Split World series out from Angry Robot. So I got a chance to meet her mm-hmm. and hobnob with her lovely publishers.
Sounds wonderful.
So that was great. That was worth it.
Nice.
The other thing is the conference was quite long. It was quite long. And I wasn't even there for the full time.
Yeah.
I got there on Thursday and I left on Sunday and it went till Monday. And I think actually you technically could have gotten there Wednesday. I was just like, that is a lot of science fiction.
Yeah, I usually about a day and a half through any conference, I'm just like, okay, so this is great, but I need a break now. And then you go lock yourself in your hotel room and, like, take a nap.
Yeah. Although I always feel like taking a nap in the middle of the day is like...
Oh, it's a disaster.
It's a disaster because, you know, A, as one of my coworkers pointed out earlier, like, I've already got all my makeup on. Like,
yeah.
Like, I've already gotten
dressed.
My bra is on.
I don't want to do that again.
Like, the only people who I feel can successfully do that are, like, the dude bro authors who don't have to, like, change their t-shirts or whatever. Like,
they go to sleep in their clothes and wake up in their clothes and just go to dinner.
And they just put a button down over it and they're fine. Jerks. But what conferences have you been to?
I have been to 2 fan conferences in my life. Because, as I said, crowds. one of them was a Harry Potter fan convention when I was a senior in high school.
Did you go to LeakyCon?
No.
Because that started as a
Yeah.
Harry Potter, but now it's like this weird sort of VidCon. Still,
I think it's largely Harry Potter, but it's not exclusively Harry Potter. This one was, I can't remember the name of the group that runs it, and they call it something different every year. But when I went in 2005, it was called The Witching Hour, and it was in Salem, Massachusetts in early October. And it was an academic conference talking about all sorts of, like, fancy things about Harry Potter, as well as a good amount of fan stuff. And it was great. It was so much fun. I was there with a couple of my other friends, so we were all under 18, so we had to have a chaperone.
Bless!
It was adorable. We were like the pets of the conference because we had matching sweatshirts, and so we were all running around and like with our chaperone with us, and all the adults being like, "They're so adorable."
What would you say the average age was at these conferences you went to?
That one was probably 30s. And it was about, I mean, it was about 95% women.
So similar to Dragon Con.
Okay, yeah.
Well, at least for the age thing. I don't know about the ladies dudes divide.
Yeah. We saw, like, one teenage boy, and we made him take a picture with us because we were like, we didn't expect to see any.
We found a unicorn! I was definitely, at Worldcon, I definitely felt like one of the youngest people. I definitely, you know, felt like one of the youngest people who wasn't an actual child of someone else attending. You know, you'd see young people and you'd be like, interlopers! And I felt like the same thing went for anyone who was sort of dressed professionally. They sort of stuck out a little bit. I knew when I, you know, got to the hotel and there was dudes walking around in utility kilts that I was in the right place. I cannot find it in me to be a fan of the utility kilt. I don't know why.
Whereas actual kilts, thumbs up all around.
Thumbs up. Thumbs up. I mean, utility kilts just feel like, to me, dudes appropriating, like, another item of clothing that women are not allowed to have pockets in.
Yeah.
It's like, I had to wear a kilt in, you know, middle school.
Yep.
They didn't have pockets. Damn it.
I'm wearing a skirt right now that does not have pockets, so I got to awkwardly carry around multiple tote bags.
Right? Right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, there was definitely a very older person presence at, which I think is a good thing, but also can sometimes be a drawback.
Yeah. It's always best when you get a, you know, wide range of people.
Yeah. I would say that was the case at Sirens, which is a conference that we both attended last year.
Yes, we did. That one was sort of as professionals and sort of as fans.
I don't think that the conference itself really knows what it wants to be, though.
Yeah.
I say this with love, because it's a really fun conference.
It's a great conference, and it's very small. There were, like, 100 of us last year, and so you sort of meet everyone, and it's probably a quarter authors that I know and like. So, it was very cool to just, like, hang out with these authors I admire. Go in the hot tub with them.
I know.
But it was...
The time that Sarah Reese Brennan replied to my Tumblr ask was one of the happiest days of my life. I was like, hey, you're so great.
She's delightful. I like her. But before this turns into just fangirling Sarah Reese Brennan...
I think we could do that as a whole podcast series.
Yeah,
like Sarah Reese Brennan is so great.
So great. You haven't even read the Demon's Lexicon.
I've read lots of her other stuff, thank you very much. She should get a Pulitzer based on her Jane Eyre parodies alone.
That's true. But, yeah, it's a small conference, and so it doesn't really fit quite into the academic or the professional or the fan sort of arena. Just because I don't think they have enough attendees to sort of figure out what they want yet, or what they want to be.
And I feel like it's also in a semi-remote location. That's in a lovely remote location.
Oh my god, beautiful. I
mean, looking at it, you know, I believe that we kept saying on the way up there, fuck you, nature. You're so beautiful.
So many trees. And waterfalls.
Worldcon. It was interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't go to very much programming. Did you go to a lot of programming at the...
Oh, yes.
Conferences you went to? Programming being, like, the panels and the workshop sessions and the stuff that they've got set up.
Yeah. Well, seeing as I was 17, I was not allowed to go hang out at the bar with everyone.
Bar con? Every conference has a bar con.
I remember we did accidentally crash one hotel room party. It was, like, two rooms down from ours, and so we got out of the elevator, and they were like, come, join us, you're in t-shirts. And so we went in, and one woman offered me a beer, and then she goes, wait, you're 17, are you? You can't have it.
I was like, aw, bless.
But it was, they were all, I did go to a lot of panels on that one, just because, since it was an academic conference, it was all sorts of stuff that I found interesting, because I have always been a huge nerd.
You've been a wonderful nerd. You're a wonderful nerd. Yeah, I didn't go to anything. I went to one panel.
Really?
Well, okay, technically I went to a panel, which was amazing. It was Mary Robinette Kowal hosting, or moderating, and it was about language and fantasy.
Interesting. This is something I find very interesting.
Well, it was interesting, too, because it wasn't just about, like, created languages. Like, it was about, like, the way that people speak.
I've read a blog post that she wrote about how, since she was writing a book set in the 1800s, she couldn't use any words invented later than
she talked a little bit about that.
And she also talked about how there were a lot of words that were invented and in use at the time period that she was writing about, but she couldn't use them because the reader would freak out and go, this is too modern.
This doesn't make any sense. One of the things that she also said that she used, there's some program that she used, and it sounded amazing, and I kind of want to get my hands on it. There's a program that she used where she plugged in, like, the Project Gutenberg text versions of Pride and Prejudice, and that was her spell check dictionary. And if a word wasn't in those books, she couldn't use it. It's like,
that's amazing.
That is so cool. I just think that you're so cool, and you're so great. But speaking of Mary Robinette Kowal and WorldCon and sort of organizational issues, did you read about the kerfuffle afterwards?
Yes.
For those who don't know, Mary Robinette Kowal, who has a very lovely but very hard to say last name, especially if one is halfway through a glass of champagne, wrote a short story whose name I am shamefully forgetting, but it was very good. I read it on her website, and it's in an Audible collection. Was technically eligible, but then made it to, like, third place in the Hugo ballot for novelette, and was then disqualified.
Well, it made it into the top five, which would have put it on the ballot.
Yes.
And then it was
disqualified
before it actually went on the ballot for final voting. And so their point was that since it actually only appeared in 2012 as the audiobook. She didn't post it until February 2013.
Yes, but the question was, since John Scalzi had won a Hugo in the same category for a similar thing, the question remains, like, why was it okay for him and not for her?
Yeah.
And the answer seemed to be, after she emailed with the people organizing it, that was just the way the committee decided.
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem a little high school debate?
A little bit.
You?
Yep. Honestly, when I was first reading it, I got, like, 3/4 of the way through the post, and I was like, well, that's fair. If they want to rule that an audiobook is a dramatic presentation rather than a print story, a print publication, that's fine, that's their decision. And then I got to the point that John Scalzi had won, and I was like, oh, that's bullshit.
It really is bullshit, and, you know, it's hard to... You know, people are like, well, you know, it's just this organization. It could have happened to anyone. I'm like, but it didn't happen to anyone. It happened to a past vice president of the SFWA.
Yeah.
You know, a past Hugo winner herself.
Yeah.
A current, I mean, she won a Hugo for Writing Excuses, which is a great podcast that everyone should listen to. And it was just so unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the problems of WorldCon have to do with its sort of decentralization, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The fact that there's no,
the
like,
fact that there isn't
governing
one,
body.
The fact that there isn't just one committee who does the Hugos every year.
Yeah.
Like, that should just be their job.
Right.
It just doesn't, I mean, it's like every year we rotated among the states whose responsibility it was to decide the president.
But that's actually very,
like, everyone had to mail their votes to Florida. And Florida had to count,
God,
like, everyone.
Trust Florida.
Well, we can't trust Florida for anything. Bless you, Florida, and bless all our Floridinian listeners, but...
Just can't trust you.
Get your
ballots.
Shit together.
But that's actually...
You know it's true.
Very common as regards book awards. The National Book Award Committee is different every year. The Newbery Caldecott Committee is different every year.
But is the administration... I mean, just the person collecting, sure. Because I think that that was the...
Who, like, the person who decides the rules?
The person who decides the rules, and the person who's sort of arbitrating the rules.
I'm not sure.
I think that it's different every year, because every committee decides, like...
Yeah.
Whatever.
Whether or not...
Anyone who knows the answer to this should please...
Call in!
Call in. Speaking of calling in, should we take a brief break for some Twitter questions?
Let's do.
Before we move on to other stuff. So we've got one question from Katie Bailey, whose Twitter handle is Emma Corelli. I feel that is confusing, Katie. You should figure that out. Coffee, tea, soda, or espresso? What's your caffeine poison?
Personally, all of the above? Not espresso. I don't like espresso. Coffee in the morning, soda in the afternoon. Sometimes tea. In between.
Usually I buy coffee and soda in the morning and drink them in very quick succession, so I don't drink tea. It feels weak.
Tea and soda, I find, are good for keeping me up while I need to be up, but not having strong after effects the way coffee does. So those are my caffeine dosages of choice at night.
That's good. Yeah, I just keep drinking coffee until it's time to go to bed, which I think is a sign that it stopped working. Okay, so...
Yeah, probably.
Andy Rogers, who has asked two questions.
Okay.
If an acquiring editor is already interested in my book, do I still need an agent?
Depends.
Hashtag slow pitch. I don't know what that means. It feels like a slang that I should know, but I don't.
Yeah. Nope, unfamiliar with that one. But it depends on whether or not you feel comfortable negotiating with them. And whether you know what should be negotiated and what's fair and what's normal and what rights you can sell otherwise. And
I think that interested and offering are two different things.
Yes.
I mean, interested could mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
Offering is, I would say, is when you should bring an agent in. I mean, I'm a big fan of people using my services.
Yeah.
You know, it is my job.
Personally, I do like it.
Personally, I do like it. But one of the reasons that it's tough, and you will hear other people say this, in fact, Dahlia Adler?
Yes.
She had a really excellent blog post about her blog about, you know, the problem with querying small presses and just generally presses in general is that our job as agents is basically to find your work the best home.
Yeah.
And be an advocate for it. And if an author has done that for themselves already, well then...
Yeah.
You know, that's really kind of our job done. And especially if, you know, and this is, you know, my hashtag don't do this is never say yes.
Yes. Right.
If someone says, here's an offer for your book, what's your answer?
Say, your answer thank you, should I'm be, going to...
thank you. I would like an agent to advise me on this. Can I get back to you in 3 weeks?
Yeah.
2 weeks, 3 weeks? Because if you say yes, then all an agent can do is dick around with terms. And they can't improve the territory, and they can't improve your advance, and they can't claw back sub rights.
Yeah.
And so there's nothing that they can do about it.
Yeah.
So never say yes, just say thank you.
They might be able to prevent you from signing away the rest of your career as an option, but...
Yes.
Yeah. Which, you know, might actually be worth the 15%. But the thing about this is I get a lot of people either who are querying me or whose manuscripts I've already requested who get offers from very small presses that I would not have sent to in probably the first three rounds of submitting. And so they come to me and they say, I have this offer from this small press. Are you interested? And so I'll read the manuscript and it's not going to get me to say yes. That offer is not enough to change my mind. If I don't love the manuscript, then that's still that.
Yeah.
It's not worth the hours of my time that will go into dealing with this contract that I might not be able to do anything with. And it doesn't mean that I'll love your next book. So if I wasn't going to offer anyway, I won't.
Mm-hmm.
And you might also be losing out on someone who will read your book and say, think this is great, we can make it better, and then we can sell it to a major house.
Or even to another small press. I mean, the point that I hope that we are getting across here, Arogers907 on Twitter, is that you want to leave as many options for yourself open as possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mazel tov if you've got interest. But, you know, agents, I think, are still sort of a really good indicator of long-term sort of...
career viability?
With the caveat that there are some, you know, shitty agents out there. Schmagents. True. If you ever hear the term schmagent, or schmublisher, or schmagency, you know, they're not quite legit.
Yeah.
But, I'm a big fan of being patient.
Yes. A lot of publishing is painfully slow at times.
Painfully slow. Oh, and if authors think it's slow, imagine how fucking agents feel.
Yes. And I know that sometimes I am the problem with it being slow, and I apologize for that. But the thing is, whether you're going to shoot for traditional publishing or try to self-publish, you have to commit to it, and you have to be patient, and you have to know what you're getting into when you go into it. And you have to be prepared to do all that requires.
Yes.
A lot of the time I will send I'll send a query rejection after 2 weeks since the query was sent and find out that they've already self-published it. And I'm like, well, I didn't lose anything because I wasn't interested.
Right.
But
it's like, well,
what if I had been?
What if I had been interested?
And then you just...
Then
it's been 2 weeks. Calm down.
I mean, I call it being book blocked. Like, oh really? You self-published it? Well, fucking thanks. Glad I fucking got excited about this for nothing.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a question from Dahlia Adler. Hi, Dahlia, hey! You're so great! Seriously, if you want a blog recommendation, Dahlia Adler's blog and her perpetual WIP series, an invaluable resource.
Not because it's not just her experience. She asks dozens of other people for what they did and just aggregates this knowledge and the advice from agents and editors and published writers, and so it's basically a place to find out anonymous opinions from dozens of people and see what's really going on so you can learn for yourself.
And coincidentally, her question is, what do you think are the best online resources for new queriers? We kind of shot our wad there.
Whoops.
Well, we sort of already answered that a little bit. I would say that. I would say, you know, agentquery.com, Absolute Right.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute Right, definitely, especially if they're, they do Writer's Beware, right?
Yes, they do.
Writer Beware is a really excellent resource because you can check to see...
No, Writer Beware is Sifwa.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, Sifwa. We're really excellent tonight.
Absolute Right.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Insert clinking sound of glass here.
Absolute Right does have cautionary tale forums.
Yes.
But Writer Beware is Sifwa and Anne Crispin. And
Sifwa being SFWA, the Science Fiction Writers of America. Anne Crispin, RIP. She's amazing. But yes, it's a great resource for figuring out, you know, who is shady as fuck and who is legit.
Yeah. And
legit to quit.
If you write children's, Verla Kay's blue boards are great. I have not spent much time on them because I don't have that much time in my life. but like, I'm just too intimidated to actually try to get into them. But I know a lot of other major agents are, like Jennifer Loughran. And so if you write children's, that's a great resource to try to get into, meet other writers, because meeting other writers is one of the biggest and best things you can do for your own career.
Yes.
Partly because they will help you improve your craft, and partly because when y'all get published, you can blurb each other.
Exactly. Well, the second part of her question was, what are your feelings on pitch contests? I just signed someone through a pitch contest.
Okay.
So,
nice.
It was, Was it Pitman? Was it Manuscript Witchlist?
Oh, well, those are different things.
No, I know. It was, I think it was Pitmad. The last round of Pitmad.
I think that's what you said.
Well, it was a pitch contest, and I'm a big fan because it's a way of indicating interest in the least amount of possible work. Because, especially like a pitch contest on Twitter where... you know, you tweet the 140 character pitch to your book.
Yeah.
You know, all I have to do is say favorite, and then I know that, you know, when that query comes in, I have to pay it special attention.
Yeah.
And my client, Marika Nykamp, I signed her through that because she was like, school shooting, multiple points of view. And I was like, this yes, sounds please. Sad. I want it. I'm a fan. I think it can also be overwhelming.
Yes. I personally have, well, here's the backstory to this. I have probably 200 queries that I have read once and have put aside for further consideration. And I absolutely cannot request all of those because, that's too much time. But we also have gotten about 1,000 new queries in the 3 weeks since my intern left. So I am swamped in submissions, and I am so far behind on those that I can't justify looking at pitch conferences on Twitter or anything else. And partly it's because I personally am so character and prose focused in what I like in a book that 140 characters just doesn't help me at all.
Yeah.
Things that sound great there might not actually fit my tastes when I read like more than two pages of it.
Yeah.
So, personally, it doesn't quite work for me.
Well, so I think that the advice that we're getting from this, is, I think it's worthwhile to authors, and I told this to an author the other day that I was friends with and chatting with online, that one of the usefulnesses of things like PitMad, even if you're not actually participating, is seeing who is participating and who is favoriting what, because yes. it's a way of sort of passively gauging what an agent is interested in, without actually having to get horribly rejected by them.
Yeah.
So, okay, I think we have time for maybe like two more, and then sure. we can close this down.
Let's do it.
Okay, Dolly has another question, but I'll save that for the end. This is fun. So maybe we have time for three more.
Okay.
Okay. So from Grace Bellow at Grace_Land, which I really hope is an Elvis reference because 10 points. Once an agent accepts a manuscript, how much does she edit it or shape it? That is, are agents the new editors? Also, 10 points for assuming that an agent is going to be a woman, because...
yeah.
Because we almost all are.
And we get so many queries to Dear Sirs.
Dear Sirs.
And your agency is not, and yours is named after a man, but mine is 100% female. So when it's Dear Sirs...
Only vaginas like, up in here. Nope. Only vaginas. Nope. Like, come on.
None of us go by sir.
Well, to answer your question, what's your editorial process with new clients?
It depends a lot on the book. Personally, I really like doing editorial work, so I actually just sent off an editorial letter to a new client today.
Don't hit the table.
So, yeah, good plan. I will stop doing my normal fidgeting.
Just fidget on the chair. The chair's not connected to the microphone.
Anyway, so I sent off a 3-page letter packed full of, can we increase this theme and this storyline in this manuscript, and it's a manuscript I absolutely love and I cannot wait to go out with because I'm just so excited about it.
I know, that's the hard part, is like, I'm giving you editorial advice, but I love you.
Yes,
I love you and never change, but change these things.
Make it better. I'm sure I can sell
make
it as
better,
is,
but don't change anything.
I'm sure I can sell it as is, but I can sell it to more people if you make it better.
Yeah.
So
I mean, do you think that agents are having to do more editorial work before, or do you think that it's just a function of how conservative the market's been,
maybe agents
are doing more than they maybe would have in the past? Yeah.
Yes, I do think that the role of the agent is becoming more editorial, in part because the market is more competitive. There are more people who are writing saleable books, and so it's not just enough to be okay anymore. You have to really stand out. And so the editors have to have a more compelling case before they can buy the book. And so it's unless you're very well established, the manuscript has to be in tip-top shape before it even goes out.
That's what I feel. And I honestly have been in the position with clients where I have asked them to edit it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've asked them to do major revisions before I'll take it on.
Oh, yes. I've done that too.
So to answer your question, Grace_Land, yes, I think Asians are being more editorial. And I think that that's actually something that, you know, I don't know if it, I would say that that's a writer beware, but I would, I mean, I definitely think that when you're in a conversation, like if you're a new author and you're in a conversation with a prospective agent, you should definitely ask them, like,
yeah,
if they don't bring it up, you just say, like, do you think that my book needs revisions? Like, what do you think my book needs? Because one of the other corollaries to one of our earlier conversations about small presses is that there are some small presses who deal in volume, and they sort of throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And there's some really great, really wonderful small presses out there, and really wonderful editors within those small presses who are doing really excellent work. So this is not at all meant as a slight against small presses, but many of them do deal in volume, and, you know, you throw something against the wall and see what sticks.
And if you don't invest any time or money in the editing, then it's cheaper for them.
Exactly, exactly. Especially if they're paid the way we are, because agents are paid on commission, and sometimes editors are also paid on commission, and the more time they spend on something without actually having sold it, the less they get paid.
Yeah. The other thing that I would say, though, is that just because agents are doing more editorial work does not mean that editors are doing none.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's, agents are not the new editors in that sense, and editors will get very offended if you insinuate that they are not doing any editing.
Yeah. And because just as the role of agents has expanded, editors have also expanded.
Yep. Basically, the goal is for your book to be the best it can be at every stage of the process, and that's the best advice that we can give.
10 points, team.
Yes.
Okay, so one more serious question, and so this is a really sort of interesting question, because I don't actually know the answer to this.
Okay.
E. Michael Chase asks, when do you think a writer should just stop revising their manuscript and start querying already? When actually the problem that we encounter is that people don't stop
revising. Oh my god.
They don't start revising.
Let's be real.
We've
got both these problems.
Well, my problem is that
I just finished this manuscript the other day.
I recently completed is code word for 2 days ago. I completed it. My mom read it and she said it was fabulous.
2 days ago I wrote the end.
2 days ago I wrote the end, and now I'm querying.
The problem I see a lot is the exact opposite one, where people email me after I've had the manuscript for a couple of weeks and say, "Here, will you look at this one instead?"
Ugh.
So basically, what I always suggest is that before you start querying, just, like, get it to the point where you're like, I don't know what else I can do to make this better. This is as good as I can make it. And then put it away for a month.
A month.
Don't think about it.
Not
a month.
21 days.
If you can revisit it again in a month and say, yes, I am still happy with this, then you can start querying.
Yeah.
And then you're going to continue to not look at it until someone comes back to you and says, I think this specific thing could be better.
Yes. I mean, one of the things we said earlier is that patience is really important. And patience also means giving the person that you're giving a look at your work a chance to actually think about your work.
Yep.
Before you, you know, change the script. So the answer is just revise it till it's done, and then, you know.
I can't tell you if you're done revising.
Exactly.
I can tell you if it's not good enough yet, but, or if it's not right for me, because it's more often the latter than the former.
So technically there's only one other, like, serious question, and then there's another question from
Dahlia.
That's fun. So I say we do both. Okay, sure. So Mary Lee, MEHR_Lee, who has beautiful hair in her Twitter profile. I appreciate a good hair game in a Twitter profile, mostly because I have been told that if I ever change my Twitter profile picture, I will not be allowed to do something. I don't know. People really like Jesus and the Velociraptor. But she says, what makes a query letter enticing? Do you like rhetorical questions and big picture concepts or more of a detailed storyline?
Has anyone told you you should use rhetorical concepts or rhetorical questions? Because they're wrong. Don't listen to anything they have to say.
I cannot speak for all agents, and neither of us can speak for all agents, but I think that it's really safe to say that rhetorical questions are not something that you should be asking in your manuscript or in your query. What we want to see in a query, at least for me, is I want to have a sense of a character taking a journey.
I want to have a sense, I want to finish it and have a sense of character, voice, and plot. And if your query isn't getting across all three of those, I think it needs more. And also, the other thing is, a lot of the time, people, in trying to narrow their book down to just a couple of sentences, take out too much. There's no detail, there's no personality, there's nothing that makes it different from half the books that are already in the genre. So I need to know what is specific to your book.
And or they go the other direction and they say, here is all the detail.
Yes.
The detail that never ends.
Let me list all and of I, the
And I venture to suggest
characters.
That if you are described, if you're writing your query, and I'm not even talking about the synopsis, because most agents ask for a synopsis of 1 to 2 pages that just summarizes the plot, like chapter by chapter, without any kind of inflection or character or anything.
Yeah, so that's just fact.
Yes, fact. This is what happens, and then I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this. But if you find yourself describing your book, and you find yourself with a really long query letter, and you think, oh, but they need to know about this to understand this. Is this thing necessary? This is a way you can know if your book's done revising. If you need a lot of backstory in the query letter so that an agent can understand what is going on, your book is probably not ready.
It's true. Really, writing the pitch is actually a very excellent way of honing your story.
Yes.
Figuring out what the catalyst is, and what happens after that, and the ultimate dilemma that the character finds themselves in. If you can't write that, you don't know what your book is yet, and you need to revise.
Yeah. I always say that, you know, going to Barnes & Noble or your favorite bookstore, and because we love bookstores.
We do.
Love Amazon too, but we love bookstores more.
Yep.
Going to your favorite bookstore and just picking a bunch of books off the shelves that slightly resemble yours and reading the back copy.
Yep.
Don't even worry about reading the book, because ostensibly you've already read the book because you've done a lot of reading in your in your genre.
Though if it's new, hopefully the back cover copy will make you want to buy at least one of them.
Yes, exactly. read the back cover, read the inside flaps. Those beats, there are beats to a pitch. And if you learn those beats, you will be able to write a really good pitch.
It's sort of, X is comfortable, but then X happens and everything changes, and what will happen next?
Yes.
Is the basic.
one of the best resources I've actually found for that lately is Dan Harmon in the, I guess it was like the early 2000s, was a really active, Dan Harmon, who is the creator of Community. He's like a big showrunner. He's really, he's a possibly insane guy, but he's
possibly insane, but also very smart.
Very smart, very talented, and does a lot of great stuff. But he has a sort of 10 stage way of writing an episode of a television show. And I'm gonna mess up the order, but we're good. It's like, and a character is in a zone of comfort, but they want something. They go through discomfort to get it, achieve it, and come out the other side having changed. And those are like the beats. And so like, you want to sort of, the pitch needs to be something that takes you to like step 8 or 9, where you leave like the question mark of like, will X get the thing they want? Or will they,
will they not?
Yeah.
Will they not? Die in the process if you're running Game of Thrones?
What's the joke? Joss Whedon, George R. R. Martin, and someone else walk into a bar and kill everyone you love?
The other thing, the final thing, when you think that your query is done, show it to someone who hasn't read the manuscript and see if they understand it. See if they can, like, explain the premise of your book back to you. Yeah. Because if not, then an agent's going to be like, what is this? No.
Okay, so last question. It's a fun question. What's the best concert you've ever been to, or what's your favorite NYC bookstore?
Oh. Best concert I've ever been to was probably Cage the Elephant and Silver Sun Pickups when I was working in radio in college. Partly because I got in free, partly because it was a sold-out show, and it was packed, and just both bands were fantastic, and it was just incredible crowd. But also my favorite NYC bookstore is Bank Street Books, which is located about 4 blocks from my apartment and is a children's only indie. And I go there a lot because they have a lot of books that I love and they are delightful.
I go there all the time and spend more money than I have. Oh, yeah.
They also have a great rewards program, which I am super excited about because most bookstores don't have rewards programs. So you buy 12 books and then you get a coupon for 10% of what you spent. And I'm like, obviously I can buy more books here.
Obviously. It's like I'm saving money.
Absolutely.
And this is all tax deductible anyway.
And
so.
You assume that 12 books at $15 each, the 10% off is going to get me a whole new book. It's great.
High five, sound effect. Well, my favorite concert that I've ever been to, if I was going to be cool, I would say that it was the MIA show at Mount Holyoke. Ooh. It was every year they would...
She also played at Brown when I was there, but I didn't get tickets to it.
She would, go off the stage and throw up, and everyone's like, she's drunk, and then, 3 months later, she gave birth, and I was like, oh, she was pregnant, you assholes.
More unexpected.
It was a really great show, but if I'm gonna be totally honest, the best show is probably one of the many Hanson shows that I went to when I was younger, because they are really excellent live.
Nice.
They're really excellent musicians, and when you are a tween girl, just nothing sets the loins aflame like a Hanson concert.
And
so.
You don't quite know what's happening. Why do I like this so much?
Well, that answers all of our questions for today. I think we do have a little bit of time to talk about diversity in SFF. Because
yes, let's do that.
One of the corollaries to the WorldCon discussion that happened, because one of the things we've been talking about is the sort of...
Yes.
The slightly less, welcoming population.
Yes.
Is that it is also a much less diverse population. Mm-hmm. And one of the conversations that happened in the wake of WorldCon was... the diversity in SFF hashtag, which, if you have time, you should go back through and check out, especially Jim C. Hines,
who was
leading the whole thing, which is ironic because he's
so straight white man.
But, I think it's really sad that, we needed, or that there needed to be, because the non-straight, non-white, non-dude
it's
population
too easy
has been
to dismiss them.
Has been shouldering that burden of conversation for too long.
And it's too easy for the... mainstream group to dismiss them. They're already on the fringes. Just push them aside a little bit more, and it's too easy. If they get one of their own disagreeing.
Yeah. So, what are your thoughts on diversity in SFF generally?
Oh, I think it's necessary. I am
do I have to have thoughts? Can I just say yes?
I mean, as a straight white female, I am only slightly
straight white cis female.
Yes.
Be real.
Yes.
Unless you've got something. Which
something
you don't have
I've
to
never
tell,
told you
which
about.
Which you don't have to tell me. It's totally cool. I love you anyway.
I'm only slightly outside of the mainstream, but I went to Brown. this is one of our major sort of... themes of being is different points of view, and I studied anthropology, and so this is something that I'm very eager to see more of, and so I am actively seeking books that represent diverse points of view, and so actually one book that I represent is a YA science fiction thriller with a main character who... is a girl living as a boy, and at the end, which, is a very common theme in YA SFF.
I'm
going to
disguise myself as a boy and have crazy adventures.
Yep. But this one, this character, is offered a choice at the end to have, gender-altering surgery, and the character chooses not to choose. That you can only have this surgery once, and so she says, I don't know if I want to be female or male at this point in my life. Why can't I be both? And that's I was like, oh my god. Oh my god. Yes!
Oh my god, that's so cool. Oh my god, that's so great.
Also, this character is not white. Nah. But also, it's a... Oh my god, such a thrilling book. Really distinctive, extraordinary voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit dark, so I'm having a hard time. Everyone's like, I like it, but it's too dark for me. I'm like, okay.
It's interesting that they're saying it's too dark and not that it's too, you know, diverse.
But, no, I had one editor say I really loved the gender and sexuality stuff in this. I think it's fantastic, but it's
maybe
too
dark. Maybe she could
murder
a few fewer people.
Yeah, I don't know. I was like, okay, sure.
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, in the wake of this discussion, I was, someone tweeted, and I'm ashamed that I don't remember, but I've drunk and slept since then, so forgive me. Someone tweeted a response, someone asked the question, what can book publishers do to mm-hmm. promote diversity in SFF? And their very simple answer, which I thought was really spot on, was buy more books.
Yeah.
By writers of color, by female writers, by differently abled writers, by, you know, different sexualities. And I was looking at my own list, and I was like, man, there are a lot of white people on it. I think my list is 100% white. I looked at it, and I didn't even realize, because my policy has always been to not pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And I think that has actually worked against me. Yeah. Well, because it's
90%
easy.
Of the people submitting are white, and most
because
of
there's
them
a submission
straight.
Because there's a yeah. submission sort of bias is that what mm-hmm. it's called, where like the sort of people don't submit because they think they're not gonna
yes.
get it, so
which is why I mean, honestly, at least 95% of the submissions that I get are not right for me, no matter who they're by.
That is 100% true.
So
a terrible book is a terrible book. But
yeah, I don't, like, when I'm deciding whether or not to reject something, it's I don't really take the author's etc. into consideration.
But
I do have on my submissions page that I am actively seeking works of that represent the full and diverse.
And I don't have that, and I need to change that, because I do. I mean, I got to put my money where my mouth is. I mean,
yeah.
So far my most diverse person is, you know, my sort of white diversity and YA founder from which she is a wonderful person and I love her and I love all of my
yeah.
agents, all of my clients, but you know, I could step that up.
Yeah.
Because I think that, you know, all those of us in publishing who are sort of the gatekeepers, you know.
Yeah.
We're keeping all kinds of gates, and we have to...
I think part of the problem is that every so often you get one agent or editor who rejects something and says it's because the character is not the straight white. That is horrifying to me, and I think that because that happens very occasionally, most of the agents and editors I know are vocal about wanting... diverse books and diverse authors. But because it happens every so often, people start to worry that the rejections that they get that are not based on that are in fact based on that.
Yeah.
And so then they start not submitting things because they're afraid that this is a boundary that they can't break. So if you say, yes, I am looking for this, it's a safe space.
Yeah. Safe space.
Yep.
So... In conclusion, Bridget Smith, Jennifer Udden, we want diverse stuff.
We do.
All kinds of diversity, and not
yes.
just these people all have different jobs. That is
oh,
not diversity.
That's the problem. It's not that I get queries from people pointing out how like multicultural their characters are and phrasing it in a way that makes it sound like the point of their book is the multiculturalness, which is also not something I want. But it's people saying, this character has an unusual job that I've never seen in fiction before, therefore it's underrepresented. And I'm like, that's not what that means.
You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. Well, kids, until next time, it's been lovely chatting with you. Keep reading.
Farewell.
Farewell. Jennifer Udden here. Thanks for listening. New episodes are available every Monday. You can find news about the podcast on Twitter @ShipAndHandling.
Our website is shippingandhandlingpodcast.com, where you can find links to books, blog posts, and other random nonsense discussed in each episode. The opinions expressed here are our own and do not reflect official opinions of either Donald Moss Literary Agency or Dunham Literary Incorporated.